Then Joseph died and all his brothers and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom, Ramesses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them.
Well, I don't know about you, but last week was like a month of Sundays for me. That was a great time of spiritual encouragement. Thanks again to everybody who worked so hard on that and all that love that was expressed there over last weekend. If you weren't able to be here, we've got some videos that are going up online, some audio from both the class time, presentation hour, and during the worship time, so you can listen to those online and get a little sense of what was going on there. As Patrick said, we've gotten a bunch of notes from people who came, who visited with us, or visited back with us last weekend. One person said that it was, quote, a dreamlike event. If you were here, you know what they were talking about. Another person from out of town for the weekend said that their only problem was, now I'm homesick. And they said this, they said, "I don't know if being proud is, quote, spiritually correct, but I am proud of the work North Lake is doing. I'm proud of your courage, determination, steadfastness, and love of Christ." That's just fantastic. So this is a much bigger church than who we are at any one moment here, aren't we? And it's really as good for my heart, I know. I kept thinking during that whole thing, this is the true reality. It's not what we so often see and or even experience out there in the world. All of the things that we see on television are about hatred, violence in this world. Those things are going to pass away. This is the thing that will remain, our relationships with each other in the Lord. The love that we've experienced there. Those are the things that are going to be there and they're going to last forever. One thing that I noticed last week was that I never heard during that whole weekend, as good as it was, I never heard a North Lake member pining for the past. Celebrating it, absolutely, but I, you know, whether people had been here for 40 days or for the last 40 years, it seemed like everybody was excited about the present and excited about the future, who we are right now, who we will be. One thing that we talked about in planning for the event was that we didn't want it to be like watching somebody else's old home movies. You ever been captured doing that? We wanted it to be about who we were has shaped who we are and who we can be in the future. That's really what we were kind of working for there. I hope that it worked. It's dangerous to forget where you've come from. This Old Testament book of Exodus that we're moving into today has been called an antidote to amnesia. Exodus is volume 2 of the story that Genesis began. They are a pair. There are many connections between the two. For instance, and as you listen to the reading this morning and then think back over the last few weeks, how many times over the past few weeks as we've been talking about Joseph has the theme of knowing or the word forgetting or forgotten been popping up there. And now we have this new Pharaoh who does not know Joseph. Here's that same theme. It's recurred here. And if when we hear it, if it was background music, if this was a movie and there was background music, it would kind of be da 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 da. Okay, this is an ominous note in the book. A Pharaoh who does not know Joseph. Bad things happen when you forget. Bad things happen when you are forgotten. When the Israelites first came to Egypt, Joseph brought them there. Everybody's happy. There's 70 Israelites, and they're welcomed with open arms. Pharaoh himself gives them the choice land to pasture their flocks. And it's all in thanks to Joseph for saving Egypt from destruction. Years pass. Many years pass. And the descendants of Jacob increase dramatically. And as Exodus puts it now, the land is filled with them. And here's another connection. Do you hear Genesis in this? The words of verse 7 actually parallel the first chapter of Genesis, where God instructs creation to be fruitful, to multiply and fill the earth. And that's the same word as land here. It's the same word. And actually, in Exodus, in Hebrew here, this word for they became numerous is actually where they swarmed. And that sounds like Genesis, doesn't it? That sounds like creation. The Israelites, you see, are doing just exactly what God intended them to do. They're fulfilling God's mission of creation. And then comes a new Pharaoh who does not know Joseph. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't know information about Joseph. You see, this Pharaoh is all about, what have you done for me lately? It's about a lack of respect. This lack of knowing is about a lack of honor, a lack of care. And if Pharaoh doesn't know Joseph and doesn't know that the Israelites are fulfilling God's creation mandate, is there any way Pharaoh knows God? All Pharaoh knows about these Israelites indicates to him they're a threat. He's all about preserving Egyptian dominance and ensuring Egypt's wealth. So he tells his people, deal shrewdly with them. What does that mean? Maximize their output. Minimize the resources we expend on them. And so the Israelites are pressed into forced labor, enslaved to build these great storehouse cities. Here they are, toiling and laboring for almost nothing, and all of the grain is piling up. All of the grain is piling up. The fruit of the earth kept right out of their reach. And Pharaoh says, work them harder, he thinks. If they're too tired, they can't think about multiplying. The Egyptians, the text says, dread them. What's happening here? They're forming these ideas about this group of people in their mind. We might call them stereotypes. They dread them. What gives these people the right to come into our country and live here, use up our resources? They don't come in with an education up to our standards. They get sick and use our health care. They're a drain on our economy. And so here you have this classic situation. Pharaoh demonizes an immigrant population in order to create a nationalistic anger. That's how dictators consolidate their power. It's step number one in the How to Be a Tyrant handbook. Every autocrat needs an enemy. And the easiest way to exploit people's fears and biases is to direct them against someone else who seems different. But the more the Israelites are worked, the more they flourish. They continue to multiply. How does this make any sense? What's going on here? Could God be at work in this? The text doesn't say. There's no mention of God. Finally, King Pharaoh brings in the Hebrew midwives. And if you'll notice, from here on in the chapter, the Israelites are going to be referred to as Hebrews. And it's an interesting word. You know, the word Israel, that was Jacob's nickname. The word Jew will come later. That comes from the tribe of Judah. But this word Hebrew pops up right here in Egypt with no explanation. Where does it come from? Well, scholars have long known that it's very similar to a word found outside the Bible's texts in ancient texts from all over that region. It's a word in English, we pronounce it Hapiru or Habiru. And most scholars think this is the word that gives rise to this word Hebrews. And in Egyptian literature, a Hapiru was any of a number of seemingly nationless folks who lived out there outside of Egypt, and sometimes who came into Egypt and moved around in their society. They looked at them as low-class folks, people who aren't civilized, poor people, typically. They're people out there who don't belong in here. So that's Hebrews. Now, as Pharaoh is casting around to try to solve his Hebrew problem, he thinks, when is it that a group is most vulnerable? At birth, from the very first. So he brings in the midwives, Shifra and Puah. Two Hebrew midwives, picture this now, these two Hebrew midwives in front of King Pharaoh. Is there more of an imbalance of power that you can picture in this society? People with no social standing and no power. And here's this person at the apex of human society who seems to have unlimited power, power of life and death. Pharaoh, I'm sure it was in consultation with his advisors. I'm sure this was all very well thought out. They had a plan. They've come up with a final solution. And he instructs the midwives, kill the Hebrew boys at birth. Now, if you're Pharaoh, you're used to people doing what you instruct. You're used to your commands being carried out. Everybody does what the king wants. The taskmasters over the Hebrew people obeyed, just like the slave overseers in the American South obeyed, just like the concentration camp guards of the Nazis obeyed. They all did as they were told. And that's why their excuse is always, I was just following orders. But before God, is this good enough? Does it matter? For instance, if abortion is legal, I know that there are many things that complicate this issue, but for any reason, for convenience sake, does that make it right? Does it matter if the president authorizes torture? Does that make it right? Why will no one tell a tyrant no? Well, the reason you don't tell a tyrant no, of course, is because there's a terrible risk in that. You might lose the lifestyle that you've grown accustomed to. You might lose your life. Believe me, these midwives know the risk. But as Exodus tells us, they determine to disobey the king's command. They let the baby boys live. They must not have known, like Romans 13, be in subjection to the governing authorities. Maybe they hadn't read 1 Peter, submit yourselves to every human institution. Or maybe they hadn't read Titus, be subject to authorities and rulers. They either didn't know those verses, or maybe those verses don't mean what some people say they mean. Now, the way they disobey is important. They give life. They don't take life. That's important. And this is going to pop up again next week in another story. But again here, I want you to notice that Exodus is parallel, echoing the stories from even the very first of Genesis. There is this struggle going on in the world. From the very first of Genesis, God has to wrestle order out of chaos, has to create out of the violence of chaos some order to create life. And then the world is able to be fruitful and to be full. But in that story of Genesis, chaos always lies just underneath the surface. And that's just at the best. At the worst, it bursts forth in places, bursts out, and there's hatred and there's violence and evil. It rears its head, and Cain takes his brother's life when they should have been celebrating this great harvest. Joseph's brothers' life is good, but they give in to the chaos within, and they hand their own flesh and blood over to a fate worse than death. And now here's Pharaoh with all the fruitfulness of his land, all the abundance there that's being brought to his land. Now he's determined to bring death on his people. You see, he's a pawn of chaos. He's a pawn of the evil that pursues us from the very first. You feel it in the world, don't you? Death. All the forces of death. But this story shows us, as Genesis has shown us, that evil and chaos are not the ultimate reality. There is a force greater than evil. There is a force greater than death. And when someone stands up against evil, when they say, no more, I will not participate in the ways of death, no matter how it looks like it's in my own best interests, no matter if it seems like I have no other choice, I will not choose the myth that I can preserve my own life over giving life to others. When people stand up for life, God honors that choice. Life has this power that breaks through. 4 or 5 weeks ago, this little bird started trying to build a nest right over our front door on a piece of wood that's no more than maybe 2 inches wide. Gather up moss and put all over our front door. It's right there over the front door, and the moss is hanging there. And I would go out there with a broom, and I would sweep it off, and I would go back inside, and I'd come back out an hour later, and there's moss up there again. And this went on for about 3 days, me battling this bird. And at one point, I had swept it all off. I took the hose out there. I washed it down really good. And you can guess. I mean, the bird's working all day long. And I come back outside. There's moss there starting again. and built a nest. And last night, I started to hear a squeaking outside our front door. And this morning, got up and looked out the window, and Gwen and I were looking out the window, and it's on this little ledge, and Mama Bird and Daddy Bird are coming one right after the other, feeding these little baby birds, putting the food right in their little mouths. It looks like there are three in the nest. Life is powerful. Life is seeking to break through death. Life is seeking to come into this world. And God honors that. I think, you know, a lot of times God's honoring of it goes unseen. Maybe we never see the full outcome in our lives. But Exodus is there to tell us and remind us, God always sees. The question is, will you and I stand up against the would-be kings of this world? The idols in this world that demand our service? You know, Pharaoh thinks God's people should serve who? Him. His state's purposes. Do you think God has a different opinion? And the only people in this story who seem to realize it and are willing to stand up against it are these two poor women. The text tells us that they are childless themselves. It appears from a human standpoint that they have no future, that there is no future in them. The future, you would say, is in Pharaoh. But these women have a deep reverence for what is sacred. They respect God. They respect what God creates. And maybe it's not so surprising that it would be them after all, out of everyone else, because they serve each day this force of life. They wait and they watch for life to break through. They are used to attending to small miracles each and every day. Their life-giving actions don't go unnoticed, though. Pharaoh calls them back into the palace to account for what they've done. Their only answer is, well, the Hebrew women aren't like the Egyptian women. They're so vigorous, they give birth before we can get there. Now, I don't know if that it was a total lie or if they had conveniently stopped, you know, answering their beeper or whatever their Egyptian version of that was at the time. And they don't get to the labor and delivery room in time. But do you really think they thought that excuse would work? The best excuse that they could come up was, we can't run fast enough to catch these pregnant Hebrew women. It seems like to me that they have kind of resigned themselves to the risk in this. They must have loved these little children so much. And if you've been following along in the chapter, you've noticed there's been no mention of God so far in this story. But God always sees. God knows where we stand. God knows if we stand and are working with the forces of life in this world or of death. And now the text tells us that God blesses the Israelite people through these faithful women. And he gives these two women families of their own. And I don't know if that means that they get pregnant and have babies of their own. I think that's probably what's indicated here. But it could be just as true. And it would be just as true. Perhaps it is truer that they become the spiritual mothers of a nation, of people, of thousands. But notice, they get what they had so deeply longed for. And they get it not by focusing their attention and love on themselves. They get it by, you know, giving their lives, pouring their lives out in love for other people. They get it not by seeking and trying to ensure their own well-being. They get it when they give themselves up. You know, and again, I can't help but think about what we saw last week here. God honors faithful women, faithful men who pour their lives into the lives of other people in love. And you know, I've shared with you at times my own basic skeptical nature. That's just me. I find it really hard to believe in most anything on a theoretical basis. I need to see things. I need to see things like we saw last Sunday. I need to feel deep in my bones the truth of things. It takes faith to show up here, to put yourself and your life on the line, believing in the one that we worship, believing in the way of Jesus, and believing in our lives together. It takes faith. And that's kind of the order that we usually teach faith in, isn't it? I think that's how I learned it as a child. I was asked, accept that there is God. Now believe, based on the story, that one called Jesus came from God to teach us how to live. Now, because of that, live that way out here in the world and with each other. But I think as I've grown older, I've needed to kind of reason this out from the other direction too. And I think if it's one whole thing, if it's true, then it's got to be true the other way too, doesn't it? That our life here and our life in this world, a life lived a certain way, validates this life of Jesus, the way of Jesus. Try living out the life of Jesus before you determine that he's not who we say he is, who he says he is. And then the life of Jesus is the experience that I need to believe in the one that we worship. I need to think about it from that direction too. I think we can experience it from that direction. So one more time, I want to say thank you. Thank God for Shifra and Pua. Thank God for Al and Ruth. Thank God for Joe and Betty and the others who've come before us from the past, who are here now in the present, for those who will be in the future, who will live faithful lives. This is what this world needs. Needs someone who will stand up and say, a faithful life lived in this world is worth something. God will take it and do something with it. God is the one who then validates that life in this world. Whether you see or we see how God honors that life lived in this world is not for us to say, is it? We can't control that. There are others who deserved to be here last week and to be honored. But they were not. Perhaps they've passed on. Perhaps they will never see and experience what the Glens and the Bastons and the Craigs did last week. But can we believe that a life lived like that is the reality that we need? So let's have that faith. Let's have the courage to pour out our lives into other people, believing that in God's hand, that's what's going to lead to true greatness. That is true greatness. You notice, we don't know Pharaoh's name, but we know the names of these two poor women. We know their names. They were preserved. In this Old Testament, in God's story, there's a different way of valuing going on there. There's a different way of balancing the scales in this world. Here's what is of true importance. What leads to fruitfulness in this world. What leads even to abundance beyond our wildest hopes. And that's our story today.